So I want to start by saying something that's deserving of a few minutes, something that's maybe a little bit overdue. But I want to say thank you to the Kaiser Church of Christ for helping to lift up my family during a very difficult time in our lives and sustain us through it. As most of you know, Marissa's mom passed away a couple months ago in late December. And this church saw that our family was in need and hurting, and you have stepped up for us. And I can't count the number of cards and emails and hugs and visits and meals and prayers. And someone even painted a picture of penguins for us, because she knew that penguins were Pam's favorite, and just a way to honor her and remember her by. So we were and are overwhelmed by the support and the love that you guys have for us. And I can imagine going through something as difficult as this has been without being surrounded by such genuine love. So we continue to appreciate your love and your prayers and your offers of support. It seemed that Pam didn't get the miracle that we were all praying for, but she got a far better one. And that miracle already happened 2,000 years ago when Jesus rose from the grave. And that was the miracle that she really needed, and that we all need. That miracle had a very real and lasting and tangible impact in her life, but especially now for after her death, because Jesus took away the sting of death for Pam. And the benefits of her lifelong decision to be faithful to Jesus are now fully being realized in the presence of God. And that's why in the midst of everything that has happened, we can still say confidently and with assurance that God is good. Whether in death or life, the cross is sufficient, and it was sufficient for her, and it's sufficient for us. So I just want to say thank you all for all that you've done for us. We love you. Let's go ahead and pray, and then I'll begin the real sermon. So Lord, I pray that you will give me the right words to say here, that you will help me to clearly and effectively communicate your message, that I will not stand in the way. And I pray that you will open our hearts and minds to your word and help us to give them sincere reflection. It's in Jesus' name I pray. Amen. Okay, so the sermon title today is The Act of Encouragement. So I'm going to be speaking some about encouragement and like the impact that it has in our lives and how, like, kind of the mechanics of that. I'm going to be spending some time talking about actually discouragement also, and doing my own encouragement for you guys. I don't feel like this title really does a very good job of accurately describing where I'm trying to go with this, but we'll just kind of see how it goes. Okay, I'm going to start by reading Hebrews 10, 24 through 25, and this is kind of a famous verse about the act of encouragement. Let us consider how we may spur one another on toward love and good deeds, not giving up meeting together, as some are in the habit of doing, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day approaching. Now, there aren't really that many things that we do that matter in the context of eternity. So have you ever thought about that? Like, the time, our lives are disproportionately spent doing things that have no eternal implications or consequences whatsoever. So for example, like the time that we spend doing laundry or homework or driving, like even for us, those are very mundane sort of tasks. And most of our lives are spent doing those sorts of things that don't really matter a whole lot. They're good things, you should probably do them, but the writer of Hebrews makes it sound like mutual encouragement is one of those rare things that actually does matter in the context of eternity. So notice in verse 25, encourage one another all the more as you see the day approaching. Presumably, he was referring to the day that Jesus will return and bring his faithful followers back home with him to heaven. And the writer of Hebrews makes it sound like encouragement is a little more pressing and a little more urgent than how we would typically view encouragement, so that we will be prepared for Jesus' return. We don't know when that's going to be, of course. But with this verse, encouragement seems like it's kind of high stakes, doesn't it? And it may not be high stakes for you specifically, but it is high stakes for people who are veering off the path. And yes, you kind of are your brother's keeper, because your brother sometimes needs to be steered in God's direction. I know I do. And if he's not steered in God's direction and encouraged by faithful people, the potential consequences are pretty disastrous. Here we go. Barnabas was called the son of encouragement. This was a nickname that was given to him by faithful people. I'm pretty sure he didn't come up with his own nickname, because that's not how nicknames work, and that would be really sad for Barnabas, and a little bit weird. But he had built up a reputation as someone who genuinely loved his church, and he couldn't stand idly by and allow his brothers and sisters to quit the race. He said, no, finish line is over here, you're coming with me. And that's what he did. And he actively pointed people who were veering off the path toward God's direction. And his entire identity was wrapped up in this idea. But not only does it say something about his character, but it says something about how much value the early church placed on the act of encouragement and how much this quality about him meant something in their lives. And you know, we have our own Barnabases, don't we? And I think it would be a good practice for us to thank them next time you get a chance, because they are doing good work, and the impact that they're having shouldn't be minimized. They are living out and obeying Jesus' command to love your neighbor as yourself in a very profound and a very simple way. So the church serves many functions. A crucial function is that it is a place where we come to be mutually encouraged and pointed down the path of righteousness. This is just an aside, but most of the New Testament was written to churches or individuals working with churches, or Jesus and the Gospels establishing the church and doing a lot of other things. But church life is the context for our scripture. Living life immersed in the church is the context for our faith. We aren't wired to live it out alone. So Romans 1:12, Paul says that you and I may be mutually encouraged by each other's faith. He's talking to the Romans, and we always think about Paul as being in this weird, unhealthy give-take relationship where Paul's doing all the giving and everybody around him is doing all the taking, but that doesn't seem to be what's going on here. He was talking to the Romans and looking for mutual encouragement. So even for someone whose faith is as great as Paul's, which is almost nobody in the history of mankind, even needed the church and then their encouragement. Now, I want to make it very clear that this is not a criticism of the people who are staying home because of COVID. Not at all that in any way. That is not the attitude. I think there's been a lot of understanding and grace in that. That is not my attitude. But the point is that when COVID dies down, I implore you, you got to come back. Researchers expect that 20% of people will leave the church permanently because of COVID. It is not a good long-term solution. It's too risky, and the stakes are just too high for that. Kara, my 5-year-old daughter, is starting to understand when Sundays are coming up, and she'll tell me, like, yay, I get to see, and then she'll fill in the name of one of her friends, and she says it in kind of a funny way. That's my best impression. Yay, I get to see whoever. And at some point I asked her, what important job do you have in the life of the church? And she told me, I keep track of the other kids. So I think it was a great answer. I think she was probably coming at it from the perspective of she wants to be in charge of the other kids. So if you know anything about Kara. But it was a great answer. I want to keep track of the other kids. Great answer. Very profound from a 5-year-old. What makes you so excited to be with the church on Sundays? I get to see Hannah and Adeline and Walter. And those are just the three names that she gave me. She's excited, of course, to see a lot more people than that. She may even be sometimes excited to see Howard from time to time. And if you don't know, they have kind of a complicated relationship. As one does with Howard. But the point is that if someone can make my 5-year-old daughter genuinely excited about being with the church, that is a huge blessing. Because Marissa and I have no greater desire as parents than to see our children commit their lives to Christ, to take up their cross and follow him. to pass along to the faith to the next generation, to finish the race, and pass it on to every generation after until the end of time. Hannah and Adeline and Walter and others may be having impact for people in my family who I will never get to meet, only in heaven. And they do this simply by being a friend. And their impact also shouldn't be minimized. So I mentioned that discouragement also matters in the context of eternity. So I'm going to spend some time doing that, talking about that. Now, this is what Bob read. This was a long section. Thank you, Bob. I realize it's long. I'm not going to go through it because there's too much text to read. 1 Corinthians 12, 12 through 27. So Paul is the author of 1 Corinthians. In his writing, he frequently addresses specific issues that arise in the church. He corrects them. He encourages his audience. But I noticed something that was kind of interesting the last time that I read this passage, and I think it was in one of Michael Beckham's classes recently. Have you ever stopped and thought about why a foot would say, "I'm not a hand, so I don't belong to the body"? Or why an ear might say, I'm not a hand or an eye, I don't belong here"? Or wonder why one part cannot say, "I don't need you"? I think the Corinthian church, they were wrestling with their identity and their place within the life of the body, but not only wrestling with questions like, what is my place in the body, but do I even really belong to it? And what am I doing here? I'm not an eye. I'm not a hand. I'm not a Barnabas or a Paul or a Don or a Julie or an Evelyn. I'm just me. Does any of that hit a little too uncomfortably close to home? That more than any other part of the body, you feel like something that's unnecessary and unnoticed, that the body would go on just fine without you. More than any other part, you feel like a wart. You know, after giving these verses some thought, it suspiciously started to sound an awful lot like Eve's interaction with the snake in the garden. Did God really say you couldn't eat the fruit? Do you really belong here? Aren't you just a wart? What are you doing here? Now, these are real things that people have internalized about their place in the body. A very important and often overlooked method that Satan uses to produce spiritual casualties is to sow seeds of discouragement, self-doubt, and feelings of inadequacy. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. I think Satan takes a very active role in planting the idea in our minds that we don't belong. Planting seeds of discouragement, that's Satan's business. And he may not be possessing us these days in the year 2021 in the United States, but I think discouragement is his battleground. Now, if you're joining us today, this is a little bit of an unusual topic. Satan doesn't pop up in every sermon. We're not one of those churches, I don't think, but I'm not even the regular preacher, so the good news is if you don't like the topic, I won't be preaching anytime soon, so give us another chance is what I'm saying. I'm not even like 10th string, but I believe that discouragement may be the primary way that he steers us off course. We can sometimes unwittingly just accept these ideas as our own self-formulated thoughts, when I think it's a lot more crafty and calculated and much more sinister than that. And here's the thing, if you've ever felt discouraged, it's probably not your fault. Expect that he is trying to actively discourage you, but by allowing discouragement to take hold, that's when we unwittingly do Satan's work for him. But in the church, I would rather speak 5 intelligible words to instruct others than 10,000 words in a tongue. Brothers and sisters, stop thinking like children. In regard to evil, be infants. But in your thinking, be adults. Now, the contrast here is that infants haven't experienced evil or practiced sinfulness, but Paul is calling the Corinthians to a deeper understanding and a more mature view of evil, because as we develop that understanding, we will have a greater appreciation for what Jesus has done at the cross. Now, how about this? Isn't it also suspicious that when you were baptized, there was so much excitement and fervor and joy, And it was completely life-changing, and your faith was going to move mountains. And even though nothing has changed since then, you now feel apathy toward God and meeting with his people. Apathy is just a lack of excitement or lack of interest. And that the cause of that apathy is completely unidentifiable. And you just accept that when you get older, that's just what happens. Faith just kind of loses its luster, and that's a normal part of Christianity. You enter into autopilot, and your attitude toward faith becomes, eh, I could take it or leave it. When we all know that if we are thinking completely clearly and rationally, that the one thing that matters in the context of eternity is Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection, in what world does it ever make sense to develop apathy toward the cross? When the cross is the one piece of hope for our souls and our eternity, we should be clinging to it, taking hold of the cross no matter the cost, and never letting go. We should be locking our arms and our legs around it, not letting Satan or anyone pry it from our hands. If you understand the implications that the gospel has in your life, then you cannot be apathetic toward Jesus without some sort of active interference in your thinking. The gospel is too great of a gift to develop apathy toward, yet it happens. It happens all the time. Is that suspicious? No, that's suspicious to me. So imagine you chose the right lottery numbers for, say, a prize of $300 million, and you sit down and you're looking at your ticket and you're asking yourself, should I cash this in? I don't know. I mean, I'd have to drive all the way across town. It's rainy and cold. It's far away. $300 million, I could take it or leave it. Now, nobody has ever had apathy toward cashing in on the lottery, ever. That's not a thing, okay? And as great as that $300 million might be, and as ridiculous as it sounds, that money means nothing in the context of eternity. What you do with your knowledge of Jesus' resurrection does. In any scenario, taking just one step away from the cross is an unreasonable option, because all other ground is sinking sand. You know, we've heard some sermons recently about throwing in the towel, haven't we? Choosing to leave your lottery ticket unsubmitted would be infinitely better than choosing not to cash in on the gospel. Even if you find yourself in Job's situation, the worst scenario you could possibly think of with suffering, do you think he would remember or even care about his own suffering back on earth when he's standing face to face with God in heaven? When there are more years in eternity than there are grains of sand on earth, and for as awful as his suffering was, I think he understood how temporary it would be. And this may be a sermon for another time, but do you think you're going to still be bitter about that job promotion that you didn't get, or your body image back on earth, or that your kids didn't get the best grades, etc.? And not to be contentious, but is the 2020 United States presidential election and everything that went along with that going to matter to you when you're standing face to face with God in heaven? Yeah, heaven's pretty good, God, but I wish I had a better income back on earth. I don't think that's how it's going to work. My favorite song that we sing is When We All Get to Heaven. My favorite line, my favorite verse, let us then be true and faithful, trusting, serving every day. Just one glimpse of him in glory will the toils of life repay. It's such an apt description of what is to come, and I think Job understood it. Just one glimpse of him in glory will the toils of life repay. The world's going to worry about worldly things. You fix your eyes on the cross. You take hold of it. Lock your arms and legs around it, expecting that Satan will come and try to pry it from you, and you never let go, because it's too precious to ever let go of, and it's too great a gift to have worry about anything else. You are a part of the body. It especially doesn't matter what part you think you are in the body. If you view yourself as a wart, the church will help you fight discouragement with encouragement, because your conclusion likely wasn't drawn entirely without interference. But consider, even if Satan had no influence and you came to the conclusion on your own that you're a wart and that you don't belong, Paul says you're wrong. You're just wrong. That's not proper thinking. We consider you to be an important part of the body, even though you may not. You have an important part to play, and if you feel anything less than that, be on your guard. It should raise some red flags. What Paul is saying is that every rationale and justification to convince yourself otherwise doesn't hold up. I think that's a big picture thing that he's talking about. Every effort to convince yourself that you don't belong, worshiping with faithful people is a flawed argument. So I'll end with this. A few years ago, when we had our yearly leaders retreat, someone decided it would be a good idea to bring the old Church of Christ directories from the 90s and the 2000s, and there was, I think, even one from the 1980s. And I'll never forget seeing some of the people, like the younger versions of people that we know and love, like the Broberg kids and Leon and Gwen, and seeing how much the Bush family has changed since back then. It's kind of cool. And lots of comments were made about, oh, that guy's mustache was pretty fantastic back then, or, whoa, her hair was straight out of the 80s or something, out of control. That's what that guy looked like with hair, whoa, or that guy never had hair. And I have permission to poke fun at bald people but hidden in the fun and the laughter was this weird juxtaposition that despite all the challenges and struggles that people had faced in their lives, that they stuck with the faith and they're still here today. And then I had heard the names of some great stalwarts of the church who had passed away before I ever came to Kaiser, and they had finished the race, and it was really cool to see them too. But then hidden within that, there was the sad reality that many others had not finished the race. Many walked away from the faith, and even some of our leaders who had been with the church for decades struggled to remember who some of these people were. Who's this person? Or whatever happened to Frank Smith? Whatever happened to the Johnson family? And you know, some people we had answers for, and sadly some people we didn't. Some people moved away, others found another church, some passed away, but others chose to self-amputate. And I don't want to beat ourselves up over this, but spiritual casualties should make us feel uncomfortable. And sometimes you can do all the right things and people still walk away, but there's always room for improvement. There's always room for growth in the area of encouragement. We aren't perfect, and I include myself in that. People don't really walk away because after careful study, they've determined that God doesn't exist anymore. That's almost never the case. It's always for other reasons. Discouragement may have been fabricated in their own minds, that they may have felt too small or insignificant to continue, or there was so much excitement at the beginning, but the excitement faded. They succumbed to apathy. It is a loving thing to do to make your brothers and sisters excited about the faith. Now, the disclaimer here is that I'm speaking from the perspective that I don't claim to be the expert. I'm preaching to myself also, but consider that there's likely this layer of influence that Satan has in our lives that maybe we haven't put words to or thought much about, and also that discouragement can happen to the most faithful and unexpecting people. This is the year 2021. We're all in a little more need of encouragement these days, aren't we? So consider how you can be an encourager and steer our people in God's direction.